Songs of realization have always been a part of the Mahayana path. In this Dharma talk, Lama Karma Chutso teaches and explains the song All These Forms. The Open Awareness Buddhist Center is a 501c3 nonprofit organization and exists solely upon the generous donations of people just like you. If you find these recordings helpful, please visit our website at www.miamibuddhism.com and make a donation so that we can maintain and expand our Dharma Center. And now, Lama Karma Chutso.
So you have two sheets in front of you. One of them has a song, and it's called All These Forms. I think it's the top song on your page. We sing a lot of songs in Tibetan Buddhism, and we do it for a few different reasons. One is because the enlightened masters who sang these songs, which are called Doha in Sanskrit, did it for a reason. They did it so that we can easily sing these songs, easily remember them, and thereby remember the Dharma and remember how to practice or whatever the song might be about. And so we use them a lot. And the master who wrote this song called All These Forms was Kenpo Tsultrum Jobso Rinpoche, who used to come to Florida every year for a few years. Now he lives only in Nepal. He's over 80 years old now, so he doesn't travel anymore. But he used to say, it's so good to sing songs because it clears the stale air out of your body. And there are very specific yogic exercises that we do every morning to do that. But, of course, during the day, then you still need to clear the loom, is what they say in Tibetan. Loom is their word for air. So All These Forms is his song that he sang spontaneously, I believe, on an airplane going from Hawaii to San Francisco in time. But he was always with the translators. So he told his translators many years ago to translate these Tibetan songs into verses that we could then put to Western music so that Westerners would want to sing it. Otherwise, the Tibetan songs all have the same melody. I mean, all have the same melody. And so it's not, you know, we get a little bored with the same old all the time. So he said, no, it has to be, melodies that are, that we like, melodies that are good for us so that we will want to sing them. So this is a song about emptiness. And emptiness in Buddhism is another word for potential. Emptiness is really potential, especially the ness part of it. Empty is one thing. It's tongpa ni in Tibetan. And tongpa means empty, but ni means the potential of being empty. So in the first verse, he says, all these forms appear as emptiness. All of them are. So he's not talking just about the things that we see, but the forms that are forms in the sense that we experience them through our senses. So like a rainbow with its shining glow. And so when we talk about appearance emptiness, we have to talk about what is appearance empty of. Any appearance that we have, any experience that we have actually is empty of something. It's empty of having any truly existent nature of its own. In other words, it doesn't stand by itself. It hasn't always been. It doesn't always stay the same. Everything's always changing. That's because its potential is to change. So it's empty of this kind of stagnant, static state. The potential can only happen within the openness of emptiness that allows things to change. And that means you, me, the air, the dog, the cats, everything. It all can change only because it's empty of having any inherent existence, which would make it always be the same. Never change. Never, ever, ever change. So there'd be no possibility there. There'd be no potential there. So that's why we say that when things are empty of any inherent existence, that gives them potential. That gives you potential. It gives you the potential to change. It gives you the potential to grow. It gives you the potential for all kinds of things, negative and positive. So he's talking about all these forms that are nothing but appearance emptiness. And he says they're like a rainbow with its shining glow. So you see a rainbow, you actually experience it visually. But if you walked up to a rainbow, you'd go right through it, you'd never see it. So that's why he uses it as an example of appearance emptiness. It's a little harder when we're talking about terrazzo floors, you know, or, you know, concrete stuccoed walls. That's a little harder to say, well, that's appearance emptiness. But at the same time, it still is, because that wall has not always been there. These walls here and the terrazzo floors came together through causes and conditions. They were made. So anything that comes together through causes and conditions has no inherent nature of its own. These walls were not always here. They may have been put up in 1947, but but there was a long history of time before 1947. So it has the whole space here and everything in it, including us. We have no inherent existence. We cannot stand on our own. We are only here due to causes and conditions and can only remain here as long as those causes and conditions allow us to. If all of the oxygen left this room, not one of us would survive. It's pretty simple. So then he goes on to say, in the reaches of appearance emptiness, in other words, appearance emptiness is everywhere. And the reaches of it, you can't reach the end of it. It's like trying to find the end of the sky. You can't. Even though you can see a horizon line, that doesn't mean the sky ends there. So in the reaches of appearance emptiness, just let go and go where no mind goes, which is really a very profound statement. Just let go is profound enough in itself. It means all that stuff that you witnessed and were witness to that was going on while you were meditating, you let go of it. In other words, you're not, one of the things you learn during meditation is that you are not beholden to what shows up. Everybody get that? You don't have to react to it. You don't have to let it take you away. You don't have to respond to it. You don't have to do anything. Just let go. So then he says, and go where no mind goes, which is really interesting, because from what I got from him when he taught this was that the mind doesn't really go anywhere. The mind doesn't really stay anywhere either. Mind is simply mind. It's not something we can put our finger on. So you go where no mind goes, because there is basically no mind. If you tried to find it, you would not be able to. Are there any questions about this first one? I know, it's a bunch. It's really a bunch. But that last line goes for almost every verse, so we only have to go through that once. So then he takes on sound. So what is sound in emptiness? It's like the sound of an echo's roll. So sound in emptiness is sometimes easier to get with than form in emptiness. Because sound and emptiness is, sound is so easy because you hear it and it's gone. So it's a little easier to see, well, yeah, of course, that stuff is empty. But then if that's empty, then why do you take all my words to be ultimately true? So sound emptiness is something that one of my students said to me one day. He said, how long do I have to take these classes? How long do I have to take all these teachings? And I said, look, the day that the words that come out of the mouth of the Lama are nothing but sound emptiness to you, you can stop taking teachings. And that's really where it's at. When that realization of it's just sound emptiness, what is that? You can have all kinds of associations with it, but it's just sound emptiness. That's all it is. So in the reaches of sound and emptiness, just let go and go where no mind goes. And then he gets with feelings. So we are trying to work with feelings in our meditation. We're trying to sort of, with technique, get around anger and aggression and pride and desire and attachment and all of this other stuff, right? And he has a different take on this. I mean, obviously we have to work on these things so that we're not at their mercy all the time. But he says, hey, every feeling is bliss and emptiness. Every one of them. And it's way beyond what words can show. So in the reaches of bliss and emptiness, just let go and go where no mind goes. It's a really interesting concept, isn't it? Because it's like one teacher said, actually he was a teacher from over 1,000 years ago. His name was Long Chenpa. And he said something to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing probably terribly, but he said something to the effect that when you miss the fact that every moment is a moment of awareness, that every moment of awareness is nothing but light, when you miss that is when you're in samsara. The samsara is the constant cycling through different kinds of lifetimes and experiences, and all of which are basic suffering. So he said, you know, you don't have to have big awarenesses. You have to be aware of the moment. And when you're aware of awareness, that's it. That's basically it. But we're missing it all the time by being involved in all the rainbows and all the sounds and all the echoes and all the words and all the feelings and all this other stuff. And we don't get that the basis of all of that, the backdrop of all of it, the reason that you can experience any of it is because of this pristine awareness that every single mind has, every single one of them. My dog has that mind, and both of my cats have that mind. That's also called emptiness, and it's also called potential. It's the potential to reach Buddha with yourself. So as Buddhists, we're not sitting around just worshiping Buddha. We're very happy that he taught what he taught, but what we want to do is become Buddha. So we try to work very hard at doing that. So then we get to awareness, what I was just talking about, and he says, all awareness, emptiness, way beyond what thoughts can know. In the reaches of awareness, emptiness, let awareness go and go where no mind goes. So awareness, emptiness, beyond what thoughts can know, opens up a real sort of basket of worms, in a sense. It's actually what the Buddha said. He said something, and I can't even paraphrase that one, but I'll get the quote for you for next week. He basically said there is something that can be known that is beyond the intellect. So when they're talking about awareness, emptiness being way beyond what thoughts can know, it's because it transcends all of the intellect. It transcends conceptualization in any form or any shape. It transcends all of that. And once that is realized on a regular basis, we can begin to call that enlightenment. But what we start off with is just beginning to be aware, beginning to be mindful, and singing. So we sing. It's pretty easy. Does anybody have any questions before we start? And no, you don't have to sing if you're shy. Any questions? No questions? Yes.
Is there another sheet?
I'm sure there's got to be one someplace here. I don't think I have any more, but you could certainly share with someone. Do you have any more?
No.
Did you get one?
Yeah.
Good.
Yes.
Okay. So here's the tune. You're going to like this tune. I think you're going to like this tune. Hi, Kim. Okay, the tune goes like this. And next week you're going to bring your guitar, right? Okay. We did this as a performance, Maria Dela and I, one time. So it goes like this. All these forms, appearance, emptiness, like a rainbow with a shining glow in the reaches of appearance, emptiness, just let go. Sound is sound and emptiness, like the sound of an echo's roll in the reaches of sound and emptiness. Just let go.
Awareness, emptiness, that awareness goes.
questions, huh?
Not about that.
You have a question?
Okay,
what's your question?
Want to learn what you guys do when you just start the meditation, like the presentation to the whatever
frustrations. The frustrations.
I'd like to learn that.
You want to learn that? Oh, that's a cool thing to learn. It's very Asian. In Asia, of course, everybody bows to everyone else all the time. You know, in Japan, China, and in Tibet, it's like this. But Tibetans have another thing that they do. When they see you, it's really interesting. They stick their tongue out. And it's odd, you know, when you walk into a room of Tibetans and everybody's going... That's what they do, you know? And in other words, you know, I'm speaking truly, sort of, is what that is. You know, I will even show you my tongue to prove that, you know, not that that really makes any difference all the time. But anyway, so usually, of course, it's like this. So when we say hello to the Buddha and to the shrine, which holds representations of the body, the speech, and the mind of the Buddha, which makes it an appropriate place for offerings and for homage, to pay homage, then we do it with our body, speech, and mind. So this is for body. This is for speech, and this is for mind, because in Asia they think mind is in the heart center. And then you go down and you touch your forehead, both hands, and both knees to the floor. So if you're doing prostrations as a practice, and some people do this even without a practice, then they're flat on the floor so that all of the chakras are actually touching the ground and then come back up again. So it's basically with my body, with my speech, with my mind, I pay homage. Yeah. Thank you. You're welcome. That was easy. That was an easy question.
How do they go on the pilgrimage?
What?
How do they go on pilgrimage?
Oh, how Tibetans go on pilgrimage? They have wooden shoes. They're strapped to wooden pieces of wood. Their hands have wood strapped to them like this, and sometimes their knees, and then they will prostrate fully, and they'll get up and they'll take two steps to where that prostration would have ended, and then they do another one. So their pilgrimage is done prostrating all the way. So even if you leave Kham, which is eastern Tibet, and you're going to Lhasa, which is central to western Tibet, they will prostrate the entire way there, even if it takes them years to get there. Wow. So when we were in Lhasa, we would get up very early in the morning sometimes and go out by bus and to different places. And every time that we would get up really early, like if we had to leave at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, there's a linkor, which means the encircling road that circles all the way around the Potala and the smaller part of Lhasa. The Tibetan part of Lhasa, basically. And the road would be completely packed with Tibetans prostrating. And they would just prostrate all the way around the entire city before they would get up and go do a full day's work. So prostrations are quite a main practice in Tibetan Buddhism, at least. I don't know that much about the others, but yeah.
Some of the old people, like Rinpoche's father, who's in his 80s, like, how many does he do? 100,000? 100,000 prostrations?
I know, probably not at that age. I mean, even Kala Rinpoche stopped doing 1,000 prostrations a day when he was like 58 or 60. So if he's 80, I doubt he's doing 100,000 prostrations. He's probably done millions of prostrations in his lifetime. But, yeah, so about 100,000 in Tibetan is called boom. It's a boom. And so you have to do a boom of prostrations and a boom of this and a boom of that. You have to do 111,111 of a particular practice,
okay.
Which is a short form.
How many times we used to do it when we start?
When you come into the shrine, you usually do 3. And then once you have taken refuge and formally become a Buddhist, then you can actually turn the prostrations into a practice. And that's where you start counting them. Yeah. Any other questions? If you don't have any more questions, you're going to have to sing more songs. What? Did someone say they had a question? No?
One of the rules about texting is you don't put them on the floor and you always put them up.
Yeah, Danielle?
Why do we offer saffron water in bowls on the shrine?
Well, basically, the Buddha was asked at one point what the best offering would be, because you always make, in Asia, they always make tremendous offerings to the guru, whoever taught them the path to the end of suffering, then they would always give them great offerings. And they expected that the Buddha was going to say, oh, gold and silver or gems or something like this. And the Buddha's answer was water is the best offering that you can make. And of course, his disciples kind of went cross-eyed for a moment and went, what? And the reason for this is very interesting, because he said, if you were to give me gold and bring it to me and leave it for me, when you turned around and walked away, you would still be taking that gold with you. So it wouldn't be a real offering. He said, but you don't have much attachment to water. I guess they weren't in the desert part of India. You don't have much attachment to water. So when you make the offering of water, you turn around and walk away. There's no attachment to it whatsoever. So that's the best kind of offering. Best kind of offering is any one that you can make without having any attachment to it afterwards. In other words, it's a pure giving. It's pure generosity or a pure offering. Otherwise, if you're still attached to it when you walk away, it's a little bit difficult. There's this story about someone who wanted to cross this really wide and very difficult, rather wild river in Asia. And it was a woman, actually. She wanted to cross this river, and she knew she couldn't make it on her own. So she spent all this time gathering wood and gathering rope and doing all these things, and spent a tremendous amount of time and effort building herself a raft. And so with this raft, she got on the raft and she actually made it across this long river and got to the other side. And what did she do? But she said, I spent so much time and effort making this, and it's such a good raft. Even though she no longer needed it, she decided she was going to try to take it with her, which was very unwise. Because how do you drag a raft with you across country? It's not so easy. But it was the same kind of deal of attachment. Rather than saying, this raft was very good to me, I did a good job of it, so if I leave it here by the river, then someone else will be able to use it, right? Instead of doing something like that, she tried to carry it with her after the use was already done. So it's the same thing with making offerings. If you make the offering and turn around and you still say, oh, I wish I could take that. So it's very interesting, but that's why. So we use saffron in the water and make it a golden color because it's just a little bit better offering. We think. We have these ideas, Not that any of it is accurate whatsoever, but but our ideas, we have them, so we go along with them. So it's nice to kind of enhance the offering by adding the saffron. Any other questions? You guys are so quiet tonight. Yes, Jerry.
How long should you leave the offering on the altar?
What?
How long should you leave the offering of the saffron water?
Oh, the water? You take it down every evening and you put it up every morning. Actually, you can take it down as soon as you finish lunch. You can take the water bowls down. The offerings over here of tea for the wrathful deities, that stays up until you're done, but that's also done by the end of the night.
Which begs the next question.
Uh-huh.
The wrathful deities.
Oh, the wrathful deities.
They like tea.
Huh?
They like tea.
They like tea. They like strong stuff.
Okay. Well, tea is the strongest of the job, but
we're not going to talk about the alcohol we give them when we do soaks.
Cuban coffee, perhaps?
You know, hey, it's Florida. They might like it. You can always try. There's no, you know, it's just, you know, in Asia, there did not used to be coffee. It was tea. So they would make the strongest, blackest tea for the deities. Deity in Tibetan Buddhism has sort of a bad rap because we have a tendency to conceive of the deity as another being and someone that we pray to. And when you pray to, you know, someone else, then there's this dichotomy, there's this duality, which is one of the main reasons why we practice, is to try to reach a state where we actually experience non-duality, or where non-duality is actually experienced by the mind. There's no you there to experience it at all. Otherwise, it wouldn't be non-duality. So, sorry. We have to be specific. So anyway, the deities they're called Vla in Tibetan, and this is a Vla Kham, which means the house or the room of the deities. And they are the embodiment or expression of different qualities of enlightened mind. So, for instance, over there you see Chinrezi, a white deity up there. He is the embodiment of enlightened compassion. Tara over here, the green Tara over there, is also the embodiment of compassion, but she is really the bodhisattva of fearlessness. If you have fears, you're going to go to Tara. In the center there is a very, very wrathful deity, Mahakala. And the wrathful deities are what we work with because we have wrathful aspects in ourselves. And we need to, in a sense, work with our wrathful aspects in an enlightened manner. And that's what they can teach us to do. The practices of the Mahakala and Mahakalis, because there are male and female wrathful deities, are for dispelling obstacles. Between Chinrezi over there, the bodhisattva of compassion, and this wrathful deity here, the six-armed Mahakala, there's no difference. Because Chinrezi was a bodhisattva who had decided that he made a vow in front of a Buddha. He said, I will work for the enlightenment of all sentient beings until samsara is completely empty. And if I ever get discouraged even once, may my body break into 1,000 pieces. So he worked and worked and worked for the benefit of all sentient beings for a long, long, long time. We're not talking about a few months or a few years here, a long time. And then one day he thought, well, you know, after all of this and after helping all of these sentient beings, if I look back at samsara, I'm sure I can see some difference. And he looked back, it was the same as it had always been. And he got a little discouraged, and his body broke into 1,000 pieces. So the Buddha Amitabha came, who was his guru, and put him back together again. And he said, this is to show you that not all beings can be tamed by peaceful measures. Sometimes you have to get a little wrathful. Sometimes compassion has to be what we used to call tough love. You know, it has to be in your face doing it. And so at that point, Chinrezi there manifested six-armed Mahakala over here, so that these two work in tandem, but they're both the same bodhisattva or deity of compassion. So those are basically what we do in Vajrayana practices, is we do the practices of different deities in the in the hope, which is really too bad. But anyway, we because you have to get rid of hopes and fears or nothing's going to work. As long as you hope that you're going to get enlightened, you better believe you're never going to do it. So, but these deities help you to, doing their practice helps you to connect with that enlightened quality of the mind you already have. Because your mind already is enlightened. If you have mind, you have it already. To access it is the question, how to access it. So one of the ways that one does this is through coming into contact with the embodiment or the expression of a quality of enlightened mind. So when Pakya Rinpoche was here, was that just last weekend? Yeah, weekend before last. When he was here, I lost a week. So I came back from Peru the day before Rinpoche arrived here in this room and proceeded to get quite ill. So I haven't been around for 10 days. But when Rinpoche was here, he introduced the students on one Friday night to the mandala of Chenrezig, so that now the practice can actually be done by anyone who received that empowerment. So in June, I think it's the weekend of June 16th and 17th. Let me just check June. It would be 17, 18. On that weekend, I'm going to give a seminar and teach everyone exactly how to do the practice of Chenrezig. And you can have your text, and you will get your oral transmission of the text and the instructions as to how to practice it. So that will be happening.
So what you mean practice is, what do you mean by practice?
You know what we just did when we were sitting in? That's practice.
Okay.
Yeah. That's practice of simply Shine meditation. The practices of the deities are a little bit more complicated because they include refuge in bodhicitta, they include a short sort of concise explanation of the appearance of the deity that you will be meditating upon. And then there are sometimes prayers, and then the mantra of the deity is practiced, and then at the end, the dedication of marriage. So that's a very basic thing that happens in these practices.
You shouldn't practice that or any mantra if you don't know that, if you don't have that knowledge?
No, you can still practice it. There are only a couple of things that you can't do, but there's absolutely no problem in going through the practice of Chenrezig, even if you don't have the empowerment. But you have to know what you can do during the practice and what you can't. The empowerment changes that a little bit.
If someone can do a Chenrezig practice this Friday evening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do every Friday evening. We get together and chant.
That's my next question. Is there a reason why we do the practice of Chenrezig on Friday night and we don't do Mahakala, for instance?
Well, we don't do Mahakala because none of you all have the initiation course. I do it all the time,
right?
But I've always had. Yeah. We used to do Chenrezig and then Mahakala, and then after that we would do fire puja and everything on Friday night. But there's no one in the sangha who knows or has any of those empowerments.
Can we request specific empowerments for the next time Pakya Rinpoche comes?
You
for
can
example.
Ask for anything you want. I don't know if it'll happen.
Aren't they obliged to give us what we ask
for? No.
They're not?
No. Absolutely not. You are obliged to them. They're not obliged to you. Actually, that you can make suggestions. I mean, it's nice to make a suggestion as to what you think the sangha needs. We're talking about two or three different sanghas, and it's really up to the enlightened master to make the choice and decision as to what he wants us to do on the next level of practice. If it were from our monastery, our mother monastery, then I could say we need this, 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 and we would get it. But no more. Okay. Any other questions?
So it's okay if I repeat the, for example, the green Tara mantra. that's okay.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. It's fine. It's great if you have the empowerment and you have the oral transmission for it and stuff like that, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. Anyone can create a Tara, anyone can create a Chinmayee. Anyone can try to make that connection between enlightened compassion and your own. So it's fine. Okay? So I will be here next Tuesday, and we will sing another song then. And also, the Tuesday after Memorial Day weekend, we will be off. We will not have anything happening that one Tuesday, and then I'll be back, and we'll go through June and most of July. Okay? Okay.
This recording is a property of Open Awareness Buddhist Center. It is offered freely to individuals who seek the Dharma. If you wish to use all or part of this recording in a classroom setting, please email us at miamibuddhism@gmail.com.